welcome to More to Come, PW Comic World's weekly podcast on graphic novel and comics publishing. We're back at the PW offices in New York City. I'm Calvin Reed, a contributing editor at Publishers Weekly. Check us out online at publishersweekly.com/comics.
And I'm Heidi McDonald. I'm the editor-in-chief at The Beat at comicsbeat.com. And you can find us on X at PW Comics World.
And I'm Kate Fitzsimmons. I'm the podcast producer, and you can find us online on Tumblr, pwcomicsworld.tumblr.com. And listeners, this is probably going to be the last time that you have the classic formation of all three hosts in the office for a little while, because Calvin and Heidi are taking off for all kinds of exciting adventures you're going to hear back from.
That's right. So enjoy it while you can.
More to come on that.
Yeah. More to come. Yeah.
And don't forget, you can subscribe to More to Come on the Apple Podcast app, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. And on Facebook, we're at facebook.com/PW Comics World.
And don't forget, you can leave us a comment or a rating or a thumbs up or some sort of mark of your feelings about this podcast on any of the platforms on which we're carried, because we love to hear from our listeners.
All right. This week on More to Come, Dragon Ball creator and manga pioneer Akira Toriyama dies at 68. Comics Retailing, our annual feature, with a guest host talking on the writer, Bridget Alverson. The Great American Novels List has been released. We'll talk about that. Marvel at South by Southwest. Scout's poor investor, and comics go to the Oscars.
Or Oscars go to the comics. That was my idea for that. So, well, sad news. Akira Toriyama, the creator of Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, a Dr. Slump, and a contributor to many, many video games, died at the age of 68, it was revealed. And, you know, a giant walked among us. He was one of the absolute all-time greats, and I think we really took him for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even realize how early Dragon Ball started, possibly because I'm an American and it didn't necessarily immediately come out over here. But, I mean, as a millennial, I remember that, looking back, probably one of the first anime I heard of, even though I didn't realize it was an anime, was Dragon Ball. That, you know, I hear many of my little boy classmates on the playground pretending to be Goku, and I would go, what? You know, and generations have imprinted on it. I mean, like, there's just been an outpouring of sentiment. Heidi, you were saying that you saw a lot of...
I mean, it was... I have not seen an outpouring of emotion and tributes for a cartoonist who passed since Charles Schultz.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Peanuts obviously is known worldwide. I mean, it's huge in Japan. And you know what? Dragon Ball is pretty much universal. I mean, I think Singapore... entire countries posted on their official Twitters, you know, tributes to Toriyama. And, I've never seen so many athletes and wrestlers and just people from every walk of life just talk about not just being fans, but how Dragon Ball touched their lives.
From our earliest days of covering, the emerging comics book market in the U.S., it was always, on the one hand, shoujo manga and Dragon Ball Z. I mean, that is probably one of the first things I learned trying to learn about manga, was how incredibly popular Dragon Ball Z was in this incipient manga market in North America.
Yeah. And of course it was adapted into anime.
Sure.
I mean, it started as manga. It was adapted into the anime, but I mean, so many people wrote about, and Kate, I don't know if this was, you know, you were the age to do this, but you know, running home from school to see.
I was the right age. Mm-hmm. Like my classmates were. But it was sort of not on my radar, except for something that, like, their inexplicable babble about my entire childhood from the people who did watch it, who seemed to be speaking a completely different language. because they were. And speaking of a completely different language, I mean, part of why a number of countries paid tribute to him is that Dragon Ball very, very, very loosely had some of its characters based on characters from the great Chinese legendary novel, Journey to the West. So, you know, countries in the Chinese diaspora, you know, including Singapore, including mainland China, were like, hey, he popularized and a lot of Chinese culture for a world audience. And, you know, he might be Japanese, but, you know, we really appreciate him.
Yeah. Well, he just created something that was so universal. And, you know, among the, you know, things, I mean, this, I didn't even realize, you know, I read Dr. Slump because we got it to review when I first started at PW, and I was just charmed by it. And that was his first manga hit. I was just charmed by, the great cartooning. I mean, he was just a great, he's just, like I said, just one of the absolute top 10, you know, Kirby, Tezuka, Eisner level. He's one of the all-time greats. He's Mount Rushmore. And, you know, Dr. Slump just had so many great characters. And the characters in Dragon Ball, the designs of them are just soaked into our culture.
Oh, yeah.
And also the phrase Super Saiyan, which is when, you know, Goku would power up for his biggest battles. You know, you see that used all the time. Like, oh, I'm going to go Super Saiyan. I didn't even realize that came from Dragon Ball. I got to be honest. And, you know, so it really, I think it was so ubiquitous, he didn't even think about it.
Yeah, it was so ubiquitous that sometimes if you look at Dragon Ball art, you might think, generic, intentionally deformed, goofy shonen art.
Right.
But that particular flavor of over the top, intentionally deformed, goofy shonen art came from him.
Yes.
They are the descendants his art style.
Yeah, and there was incredibly heartfelt tributes from Eiichiro Oda, the creator, the creator of One Piece, and also the creator of Naruto. They both talked about meeting Toriyama-sensei and just, you know, being starstruck by him, and but you know, how getting to meet him was one of the highlights of their lives because they love Dragon Ball so much. And obviously Dragon Ball is a huge influence on One Piece and Naruto. And, you know, it's, just huge. And, you know, another one from Dragon Ball is Kamehameha, which is the super wave, that Goku uses. And, you know, that's another one that you hear kids shouting at because, you know, Kamehameha. So it's, you know.
And generations of kids.
Generations.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah. If you think about all the way back to the manga coming out in 1984, that means that in Japan, there are grandchildren people who grew up on Dragon Ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
As teenagers.
Yeah.
Who now have grandkids who are also enjoying Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
The New York Times says it's the best-selling manga series of all time and has sold more than 260 million copies worldwide.
Yeah.
Not to mention the games and the anime and all of this other cultural and media influence.
Yeah. It's just, it is, like I mean, I've always been a huge fan of Toriyama. And, you know, when you go to San Diego every year, they have that big Dragon Ball, display of all the characters. And there's always something fun to see back there. But, I do think we took it for granted in a way. And, you know, the fact that he's gone at the relatively young age of 68.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, there is a piece that talks about how mangaka die much younger than average, Japanese man. And it is a hard life. Maybe we'll return to that.
Yeah.
But Toriyama, one of the all-time greats, gone too soon.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about our annual comics retailing feature, and we're going to talk with Bridget Alverson. Hey, Bridget.
All right. Oh.
Okay, deep breath.
Yo.
Three, two, one.
All right, more to come, listeners. We're going to engage with, really, I guess, the latest evolution of PW's comics coverage. In our comics retailing issue at PW's, this week's PW, not only do we have the annual feature on comics retailing by the fabulous Bridget Alverson, we've also got coverage of the boom in middle grade graphic novels, the process of adaptations. We're going to talk about the data transformation in comics shops done through the metadata project from Comics Pro, and probably lots of other things. And we've got Bridget Alverson herself on the line. Hey, Bridget, how you doing?
I'm good. Glad to be talking to you again, Calvin.
So this is great. Yeah, well, you know, I'm around. You can always talk to me.
True.
But it's good to have you on the program. So look, why don't you walk us through this? You've done the comics retelling feature this for this issue, and so much more. So I see the sort of the major thing going on with the comics retailers. You're really focused, as we often do in this particular feature, on the direct market and the local comic shops. So what can you tell us about it?
This was really interesting to me, because it's been such a difficult few years for the comics industry. If you had asked me, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was still new at this, if I thought there would be a future in comics retail, the direct market, as they call it, I would have said no. It seemed like a cumbersome, outdated system, and yet people have embraced it more than ever. So after the pandemic, after all the adjustments that had to be made, all the changes that happened, the biggest one probably was the splintering of the market. There are now three distributors where previously there was one. Comic shops have come through in a really interesting way as a real locus of pop culture. You know, the third place where people go, people who are comics fans, but also people who are movie fans, people who are game fans. Like, there's the stores offer a lot. It's no longer just a rack of new comics and some long boxes with back issues. A lot of stores have cafes. They have, game sections and game nights. And they really reach out to their customers in a lot of different ways. So to me, it was very interesting to go out and talk to some retailers from across the country about why they do what they do, how they're making it work. The numbers are that, you know, comic shops are doing okay. Periodical comics, which are the thing that is unique to these stores, their sales have basically kept up with inflation over the past 20 years, not really moved ahead. But there's a lot of other richness to these stores that you don't necessarily see unless you go into them and talk to the people that run them, or just go into them and buy a bunch of comics.
To react to the things you said a little earlier, I couldn't agree with you more. I was always under the impression that the book format would take over. But really, these stores offer a mix of products, both the traditional American comic book periodicals, as well as book formats. And one of the things your feature seemed to bring out is that there's still a very healthy marketplace for sales for periodicals. But also, I mean, the way comics retailers, direct market stores, offer a place of community, it's essentially a community center for comics readers and fans.
Absolutely. And one thing that was really interesting to me, too, was you no longer see the store with just a rack of periodicals and some long boxes. You know, how much the whole field has really broadened out, I guess. One of the retailers that I spoke to was Avi Ehrlich from Silver Sprocket. And their store doesn't carry – and Silver Sprocket is both a publisher, a small publisher, and a retail store. And their retail store has, you know, like the photos of it are beautiful. They have a huge array of things, but they don't carry new periodical comics. And so when I spoke to Avi, like, they really had a different, whole different vision for the comic store as a place that actually publishes comics made by local artists and uses that as a way to bring in the community. So their store has like a wonderful graphic novel section with stuff from First Second and all the good publishers. They carry a lot of small press and micro press comics, you know, mini comics, self-published comics, that sort of thing. But they also are a center. In addition to being a place that draws things in, they're also a center that kind of brings things out by bringing the community in for events and publishing the works of local artists. And I thought that was a, you know, and Avi pointed to several stores throughout the country that have a similar model. It's unusual, but I think it is particularly in a place like San Francisco, which is where Silver Sprocket is, it is a very workable sort of a model for a store.
Yeah, I mean, Avi is kind of a new wave comics entrepreneur in so many ways because he's really reaching out. I mean, he really kind of represents how we're in a marketplace that's so different, and he's reaching out to all kinds of segments of the community, both to distribute books and to publish them.
You know, I want to jump in here and just kind of stand up a little bit for the comic shop and its own history, because really it always has. The successful comic shops have always been a nexus for our community. And that's really what the whole Wednesday warrior stereotype came from, was the idea that people were going to the comic shop on this day and meeting other fans and talking about the day's releases. So, you know, I think Silver Sprocket has taken the whole idea of community to the nth degree. And I mean, I, you know, I was in the store last year and it's just so gorgeous, and Avi and their crew have really done an amazing job. But, you know, there's other stores that have this whole, you know, this community is word one when it comes to comic stores. You know, Bridget, you did the story this year.
Yes.
A little different format, because in previous years it was more of a survey, I believe. And so, and this is the first time you've written the retailer feature for PW.
That's correct. That's correct. It is. But it is somewhat informed by my work for ICV2, if I'm allowed to mention another publication, which is really a website whose primary audience is comics retailers. And over the past year, throughout 2023, Milton Greep, who is the editor of the site, really like put together an amazing oral history of 50 years of the direct market, which was fascinating to me because I saw how the direct market came together. You know, you could almost say it's like, oh, let's invent a new publishing sector. We can use my father's barn, because it started in a very ad hoc way, and it grew in a number of different directions. One of the things that was definitely, there's no economy of scale the way there is with a Barnes & Noble, right? There's no Barnes & Noble of comics. But the thing that kind of held things together and made it work, unified things, was Diamond, which was the sole distributor to the comics market for 25 years. And that sort of brought an order and a uniformity to it. And so the fascinating thing has been, with two other distributors coming into the scene, how does that change things? And retailers will tell you, well, it triples the work. But it also exposed a problem, that the problem of metadata, which there's a whole sidebar on, which is just that, like, how do you describe comics? And as someone who does a fair amount of work with the data, I can tell you that it's always been wildly inconsistent, down to the title of the comic will be different in different places. So Comics Pro, which is another kind of unifying force within the industry, and that's the association, sort of the trade association for retailers, they have been attacking this problem. And I think Comics Pro is another factor, because they have kind of stepped up, especially, they've always been there, they've been around for 20 years, but since the pandemic, their last two in-person meetings have been a real kind of creative space where people are taking on the problems that they deal with as retailers and looking for solutions. So I see a lot of growth and optimism, which surprised me, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised. The other thing that's happening – oh, sorry, Heidi.
No, go on.
No, I just want to say there's another thing that's happening, which is because the direct market is 50 years old, a lot of the original retailers are retiring. But that doesn't mean that it's dying, because there's a whole new generation who I think grew up with a different concept of comics, grew up reading Calvin and Hobbes or Raina Telgemeier, and are bringing a different kind of an energy to it. There's still plenty of traditionalist comic shops. There are also a lot of comic shops that really reflect the tastes of their owners, which I suppose has always been the case, but in a more expansive way.
You know, Bridget and I both went to Comics Pro a couple of weeks ago. I guess it was only 2 weeks ago. Holy cow. Seems like 8,000 years ago. And we shared breakfast a couple of days with a retailer who's kind of the old school type, right? You know, that guy, and I don't remember his name, but
the one who didn't have a computer.
Well, yeah, he didn't have a computer. Doesn't use a POS system. And he was older, and he just admitted that he was going to keep doing what he liked until he died. But he had a partner with him who was listening intently and to some of the more modern types of proposals going out of Comics Pro. And, you know, I did look up on Facebook, and I found that he had posted about Comics Pro. So he's on Facebook, and he does Facebook videos.
But the thing is, Heidi, Facebook is – very popular with people of a certain
generation. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
In a way that can be used on the cell phone. Was he may indeed not have a computer at all.
Yeah,
it may just be him, his cell phone, and Facebook.
I think he has a computer. I think he just doesn't use it in the store. Mm-hmm. He does not have a computerized POS system, which is really Luddite. But it is funny how we think people are Luddites about one thing, but yeah, you know, they use Facebook. So they're like, oh, let me make a video. But anyway, I want to say even that guy who Bridget and I were sort of like, is actually using, he really got a lot out of Comics Pro. He was talking about it very positively. And, you know, I think that came across actually in some of his comments to us.
Well, look, I think what comes across really is how we are in a new generation of retailers. Who are, you know, are looking for new ways to serve their customers. You want to mention the stores that you talked to?
Sure. So we were looking for stores across the country, and I think we succeeded admirably. We talked to Tony Davis, who's the owner of Million Year Picnic, a venerable comic shop in Harvard Square here in Massachusetts, and then Bob Moreau from Westfield Comics in Madison. Sienna Fallon, who is the COO of Ultimate Comics, which is a chain in North Carolina that has 5 shops. And then Avi from Silver Sprocket in San Francisco.
And just as a reminder, our last week's episode of More to Come was Bridget and my – it was a crossover with Bridget and I talking to Sienna and to Sarati Gasmala of Phantom Comics. So, you know, if you're interested in comics retailing, please listen to last week's episode because we have 2 retailers on it who are really smart and awesome.
So in the feature, was there anything that people were particularly focusing on as having changed recently?
I think the big change continues to be the 3, going from 1 to 3 distributors. Mm-hmm. That has had a lot of ripple effects. The other thing that's happened, there's been a lot of talk, I'm sure you've heard it and I'm sure you've talked about it over the last year about like the content isn't very good, you know, people weren't very excited about comics. And that has changed. One of the things that I think made a big difference was when Skybound did a kind of a stealth reveal. So they acquired the license for Transformers and G.I. Joe from Hasbro. IDW had been publishing these comics for years. We knew that IDW had lost the license, but there was no official announcement of who had picked it up. And then the Transformers just showed up in a comic book Void Rivals number one. And it really had an energizing effect. The fact that they would make that announcement by putting a Transformer in a comic rather than, you know, blasting out emails to people like me. And they did inform the retailers beforehand. They had, they do like Image does a call like, you know, every couple weeks with about 100 retailers, and Robert Kirkman got on the call and he said, look, you guys, you have to keep this quiet. Amazingly, they did. And so there was no leak until just a day or two before the comic came out, but they made their big reveal in the stores to the readers. And I think that's been, you know, the other thing is, and Sienna makes this point in the article, they got really good creators, crossover creators, to work on the stories. So that has really been kind of one of the big events recently. And we saw again, with the launch of, Ultimate Spider-Man in January and then Ultimate Black Panther, the following month, that again, a lot of energy around that, a lot of excitement. So some of the mojo is coming back.
Well, you really put together a good survey of the current retailing landscape, but also kind of a useful guide to
yes,
the direct market. Because how do you know when you're in a direct market comic shop?
You know, when I first started writing about comics, as you know, I wrote about manga. And so I had no exposure to this, and these things used to puzzle me. People would be writing about previews and Wednesdays and solicits, and I was like, what are these? Where do you get comics anyway? I hadn't been in a comic store in 20 years. So there's
variant covers.
Variant covers. I remember the first variant covers on TV Guide back in the day. So yeah, there's a lot. There's like every subculture. Comic shops have their own language and their own way of thinking and their own way of doing things. And so there's, you know, the notion that Wednesday is the day that you go to the comic store. They call them Wednesday Warriors to pick up the comics that you actually ordered 2 months ago from previews, which is or
new
now.
Day.
Yeah. You come in on New Comics Day, but you ordered your comics 2 months ago because that's how it works. You know, and just, yeah, variant covers, the fact that the same comic could have as many as 20 different covers, which is just insane to me, including, you know, like there's metal variants and there's like made of metal variants and, yeah. You know, stuff like holographic covers and foil covers, and people are always coming up with something new to do to the covers.
Yeah.
And people like that. It's an opportunity, I think, for artists to get a little extra work, and people really enjoy, you know, people who like variant covers really like them. I'm just
So are there any things that over the years you've been observing comics retailing that have been added to the Wednesday Warrior repertoire of things that an outsider might not know going in but have become part of that Wednesday Warrior culture?
Not specific to Wednesday Warrior, but I think the whole concept of slabbing comics. So, you know, there's always been a notion that comics are collectible, and the whole issue of back issues fascinates me. But lately there's been a lot of interest in what they call key issues. Like, what's the first appearance of Spider-Man? What's the first appearance of this character? And, people get their comics professionally graded and then encased in a plastic slab.
Mm-hmm.
Which
we talked about it.
Yeah, we talked about that. We talked about the whole CGC crazy thing. So.
Right.
Hey, one last thing. Could very quickly you give us, you've got a second feature in this issue, and it's the middle grade graphic novel.
By the way, I do not recommend this to aspiring journalists. It was kind of a coincidence that I ended up writing two stories for the same issue. But yeah, the other thing I was interested in, and it really tells you how far comics have come. The other story that I did was about graphic adaptations of middle grade novels. And the classic, the bestseller is The Babysitter's Club, which was kind of a brilliant idea on Scholastic's part. But now what's really interesting to me was, as I spoke to the editors, you know, they were talking about, yes, we've edited this series for a long time, but now, like, it's almost like you used to adapt a prose novel to get the comics readers reading it, and now it's like you want the comics readers to read your prose novel. It's kind of reversed. The graphic novels have become such an important driver in this market that now people are thinking, you know, let's get those graphic novel kids to read some of our stuff rather than the other way around.
All right. Yeah, well, it's a really great issue, Bridget. You've done double duty.
Thank you.
thanks for coming on to tell us.
Yeah, thanks, Bridget.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Yeah, all right.
All right. Well, it's always good to talk to Bridget Alverson.
It sure is. It sure is.
We love you, Bridget.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Heidi, the great American novel.
Well, the Atlantic, here we go. The Atlantic put out a list of great American novels this day, and they did 100 novels, I believe. And there are 3 graphic novels on this list, which are Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, Sabrina by Nick Dranasso, and A Contract with God by Will Eisner. And I should point out that there are several kind of comics-y adjacent books that are about comics on there. Cavalier and Clay Michael Chabon is on there. And I believe there is one other one, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Junot Diaz, which has a few has a few comics-y connections there. So
and of course a number of these prose novels have been adapted into comics.
Yes, that's true. That is true.
But I have to say, with those 3 graphic novels, there's only one thing that keeps playing in my head.
What's that?
One of these things is not like the others. One of these things just isn't the same.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Well, this list is so epic that it's gotten our least tuneful podcast partner to actually start singing. So this is how epic it is. Look, I mean, Watchmen was on the best 100 novels of the 20th century list. Yeah. And I don't think anybody ever questions that Watchmen.
Yeah, that one should. Fits.
Yeah, we know Watchmen's great.
Contract with God, absolutely.
Well, you could argue with that for sure, but, in some ways, but sure.
Of course,
we're putting
it's
it on
also
there.
Not a novel.
It's also not a novel.
It's a graphic novel.
It's a collection of short stories, but they're all set in the same. They're kind of interconnected.
They're all interconnected.
And they're the same. Yeah. I guess the controversial one here is Sabrina by Nick Dranasso. And, Dranasso has gotten a lot of acclaim. He was profiled by The New Yorker. And, I don't hear people talking about Sabrina, the way they do. So I'll just say this. Nothing against Dranasso. He is incredibly talented and his books have a lot of meat to them. They are by no means, they are full of subtleties and depth. That's it. He wouldn't have been my pick, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I could be wrong. I could be wrong, but the rest of these are, how shall we put this, generally acclaimed classics.
Oh yeah.
By which I don't even mean just the graphic novels. I mean, all the books on that list. There are very few shockers on there. It's all very like, yep, makes sense, yep. And I don't know, I could be wrong, but I'm getting the same vibes from this that I get at very earnest indie bookstores that have people who are theoretically in favor of comics, right? Who have maybe not read that many?
Well, I mean, it does have, excuse me, it does have books post like 2010. And you know what? It's hard to assess books from the last 15, 14 years. It's hard to assess recent books. So, you know, they have books on here. I mean, I haven't read any of them. So these novels, I couldn't, you know, I've heard of them because some of them are in the conversation. You, Calvin, before we're going over the topics, you had a pick, your pick for what you might have replaced it with.
I mean, I just feel that, I mean, I do feel that, we still, that there's a bias against graphic literature moving into the realm of great literary art. And look, maybe I'm just being, you know, paranoid about the cultural space, but I do think that there's a sort of sense that, you know, stay in your lane, comics. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be literary over there. And I think that's unfortunate because I do think overall there are, that there should have been more than three. I don't know how many there should be, but I think it should be more than three.
Well, what else would you nominate?
I've got some in my head, and I will say this. There's certain books that are actually memoir, or autobiography, although I think there's some prose autobiography on this list too. So this isn't purely, what we would call, you know, classically a novel. But, my own feeling, is that, Emma Ferris's My Favorite Thing is Monsters is really an extraordinary work of great literary significance, in my opinion.
I would not, I wouldn't, you know, that would be in my conversation.
And I would, one more that I think should be on this list, is From Hell.
Well, they,
and,
yeah, I think they would avoid having two books by Alan Moore on here. No, you know, listen, listen, there's
one Alan Moore is sufficient.
You know, there's some genre hits on here. I'm just looking. They have The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. It's one of my favorite books. They have, Charlotte's Web on here.
They have a book by N.K. Jemisin on here.
They have, they have, A Wrinkle in Time.
As they should.
As they should. It's a great book. They have Stephen King on here.
I mean, this is a good list.
It is a nice one. The Stand by Stephen King, which, you know, that was a great book. Yeah. You know what I might make a, I do think My Favorite Thing is Monsters. And Kelvin, I'm looking very quickly. I do think this is not a thinly veiled autobiography on here. These are novel novels. And I really like the fact that
I thought I saw some of that. But yeah, that's
I like the fact that they're novel novels. They're made up stuff. So this book that I was going to suggest, and you know what? It isn't really a novel. I was going to say, you know, I'm a huge fan of like, Eleanor Davis. I think How to Be Happy is a great book.
It's a wonderful book.
It's a wonderful book. But you know what? It's not a novel, so that's fair. I do think there's a lot of our finest cartoonists like Jillian Tamaki and, you know, just so many others have, I would say so many others, but there is a real cadre of people whose names I should look up so I remember, who have done short fiction that I just think is literary in every sense of the word. And, but they're not novels and that's, that's fair.
Well, I mean, maybe we need someone to put together the great American graphic novel list.
Yeah. That wouldn't be a bad thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I gotta say, like, for all you're saying, oh, it's hard to find things in the last 10 years. Like, I'm looking at a lot of these books from the last 10 years and I'm like, oh, I know that book. I like that book. That's, I can see why this book is here. Mm-hmm. Like a brief history and seven killings. Like, well, that's amazing, right? Like, I get it. Whereas Sabrina is, again, no offense to Nick Donoso, it's just kind of a like, huh.
I mean, it's not a book that people reference very much in our world. I don't hear people talking about Nick Donoso all that much.
No.
And I get that he is admired and good. Good for him.
But I don't know.
Well, Faulkner has two novels.
That's fine. But they don't have the Great American Novel by Philip Roth on here. It's one of my favorite books, but anyway.
Well, I mean, I would have to say another book that I think is of the level of the books we're talking about, but I can also understand why it didn't get on because it's an adaptation. I don't know if you can guess what I'm gonna say.
No, I can't.
City of Glass.
Oh yeah. No, but that Calvin, that's an adaptation.
I'm talking about the quality of the book.
Yeah, but you can't, I've gotta stop you there. You can't pick an adaptation of a great literary work and say it's a great literary work on its own.
It is a great literary work. In fact, it's part of the comics canon of great literary work.
It is, but
I'm not the only one that says it.
No, so. I know, but I'm
not disagreeing.
I'm not disagreeing, but I'm saying
it wouldn't fit for this list.
Yeah,
well, that's what I said.
Yes,
that it wouldn't fit for the list. But if we're on this discussion of works that certainly have powerful literary significance,
yeah,
that is one. That's one of the canons of
Yeah,
comics,
but it's also based on a great book.
Absolutely.
They didn't make up the story. In setting out, I'm going to read this from the intro. In setting out to, identify the new American canon, we decided to define American as having first been published in the United States or intended to be read more in our entries than Lolita and the Bell Jar. We narrowed our aperture to the past 100 years, a period that began as literary modernism was cresting, and contains all manner of literary pleasures. Let's see. They don't really talk about the criteria that we just mentioned, but it's pretty obvious that they did use them, and I think that's cool. I said, let it be a story. Let it be a story about stuff, not a – well, look, you know, we're kvetching here, but I think it's really cool that there was three graphic novels on this list.
Yes, I agree.
And because the books on this list are by and large the books that you have to read – like The Great Gatsby and A Farewell to Arms and The Sound of the Fury and USA and Day of the Locust and All the King's Men and so Catcher in the Rye. So yeah, this is a great list of classic books, and there's three comics on it. So.
And it's also, it also I think reflects, the changing understanding of, American literature. With more modern works too.
Yes.
Paul Beattie is on here. N.K. Jemisin, as you mentioned earlier,
on here. Yeah. So it's
Marlon James is on here, you know,
Chimamanda
Ngozi Adichie, she's on here. Mm-hmm. So this is, yeah. So look, obviously it's an extraordinary list. Juno Diaz is on the list. So.
Wow.
But, a guy can wish, huh?
Yeah, you know, I'll send you to on Comics Beat. We do have a list. It's hard to find since Google is burying our results, whenever you search for us, right now. But we do have 100 best comics of the decade for the teens. And there's a lot of really great books on there. Check it out. Yeah. They might find something that you think might have been,
a strong candidate.
A strong candidate. Yes. So.
For sure. All right. So, Marvel at South By?
Yes. Well, so kind of quickly. So by the time you listen to this, we will be hip deep in the discourse. But, Marvel has made a little habit of going to South by Southwest, which is underway right now as we speak. And they usually do some kind of announcement. And so they saved the announcement of their waiting for the siren to come by. While I wait for this story to find out. So they went to South By, and it's been rumored that there was going to be a revamp of the X comics. And sure enough, they did announce this. And, the X comics are being taken over by Tom Brevoort as editor. And, so I don't actually read the X comics. I'm just going to read the teams. Let's see. There's X-Men by Jed McKay and Ryan Stegman. From their new base in Alaska, the X-Men raise a flag of defiance towards Cyclops, Beast, Magneto, Psylocke, Kid Omega, Temper, formerly Oya, Magic, and Juggernaut. All right. That's one team. Okay. Then there's Uncanny X-Men, which will be written by Gail Simone. Mm-hmm. With artist David Marquez. Mm-hmm. Making themselves at home in the Big Easy, these X-Men protect a world that hates and fears them. Join Rogue, Gambit, Nightcrawler, Jubilee, and Wolverine on explosive superhero adventures. That sounds like the classic team to me. And then there is a third book called Exceptional X-Men by writer Eve L. Ewing and artist Carmen Carnero. Katie Pryde has returned home to Chicago following the war with Orcus. Having stepped away from the world of mutantdom, she has nevertheless come back with a trio of new young mutants, Bronze, Axo, and Melee, who clearly need training and guidance. So again, I'm not.
Well, I can say something.
Yes.
It's not a surprise that the mutants you recognize and the creator you recognize are on Uncanny, because Uncanny is the flagship book.
Correct. Yes. And, so I can tell you this. That Twitter has burst at the seams with all this, because there's a lot of X fans out there, and they are super opinionated, of course, and they don't like that Cyclops is here, and they don't like that Rogue is there, and they don't like these makeup of these teams, and of course, you know, the haters are out for Gail Simone because they hate her.
Let's not
they
bury
hate women.
The lead here, and that is. There's a reason that X-Men was not getting top of the billing treatment at Marvel for a long time, because they had lost the movie rights.
Right.
And it went from being the jewel in the crown to being something that Marvel was almost intentionally not promoting very hard.
That,
and now they are promoting.
But the, well, I mean, we gotta go back to Jonathan Hickman when he relaunched the X-Men. I would say it was like 2 or 3 years ago. Again, I'm a little hazy in timeline. But you know, he had this whole Krakoa, not Krakoa. Boy, that's an in-joke. Nobody but one other person's gonna get. Anyway, he sent them to Krakoa. And this was a huge revitalization for the line, right, Kate?
Right. I mean, it's not so much that as that. I'm not saying there weren't good X-Men books in between.
Yes,
I'm saying that certain powers that be at Marvel were not actively promoting.
No,
X-Men
I mean
the
this
way
is
you'd expect.
This is well known, and this started
and
with the...
they weren't even with Hickman. They weren't promoting it the way a book of that strength.
I would argue with that. They really made that the flagship book.
They eventually did.
No, I would say eventually. They launched it with a huge promotion.
I feel like
this is why it's a horse.
Here we go. This is it. And they're off. You know, is what happens.
Knowledgeable people can disagree.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess my perspective is I was there in the late 90s, like, publicity bonanza of X-Men, and comparatively speaking, I feel like things are going in a more X-Menly direction again.
Yeah.
There's an arc. There's an arc from Hickman until now, and the arc is going upward, and X-Men deserves that arc.
Right. And here's the other thing, though, that has got a lot of people upset, is that apparently Hickman had a 6-year plan for the X-Men, and it's been cut short for this new reboot.
Well, so but that's traditional.
Yes, that is
traditional. That's what happens every single time. Every time some creator is like, here's my grand plan for the X-Men.
Right.
And they're always able to get 3/4 of the way through before Marvel's like, that's great, let's do something new. It's always. Never fails.
I think
every single time.
I think you can tell just from Kate's and my, and you know, someone like me who hasn't read the X-Men in over her years, but does cover Marvel, you can tell, that we're off. There is discourse happening around us like the end of Fight Club, okay? It's just exploding. Yeah. The end of Apocalypse Now. It's like this extra footage from The Shining. Everything is blowing up, all right? Okay, there was one other announcement. I think this is sort of tied into South by Southwest, but I'm not sure. I literally just got this press release as we were sitting down, so I don't even know what it means, but, they're launching VV Comics. Remember NFTs, you guys?
No,
do you remember those?
No,
now they're called digital collectibles or premium digital collectibles.
I can't wait until Patrick Boyle does another YouTube documentary on why this one's a scam too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patrick Boyle. Guys, Google him. He's great.
Well, there's a lot of inventory. They got to move it somehow.
Yeah. Well, they are teaming with Marvel. The VV Comics, the multi-publisher platform's debut with Marvel Comics as its first publisher offering comic book enthusiasts access to 300 plus new Marvel digital issues on launch day and new comics added weekly on the same day the titles are released in print. Interesting day there. VV's technology allows users to read comics panel by panel. And each page is converted into the digital experience by hand. Anyway, you know what? I mean, interesting, for sure, interesting that they're still trying
collect
to
them all.
Flog these. You know, you guys, this is not on the run sheet, but, did you see that story about Kickstarter? There's a big expose about Kickstarter on Fortune magazine, but it got syndicated and it just talks about their pivot. And apparently they had like investment from Andreessen, which is the big VC company.
Their pivot to the blockchain?
Yeah. Remember when they, they never did.
Andreessen Horowitz.
Yeah. Andreessen Horowitz was behind that because they,
Shocked.
Shocked.
Anything stupid with the blockchain has Andreessen Horowitz written all over
it. And it's just, you know, and guess what? It destroyed Kickstarter. So now, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they, there's a job open there, and normally it's called a platform manager? But now it's called the retention manager.
Well, that says it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, because just to tie this in, and again, I'm sorry to spring this on you guys, but I did. This was a big story this week that didn't make our story list. I should have put it on there. Brandon Sanderson did his crowdfunder, and it was like made an insane amount of money, like millions of dollars. I don't even have the number in front of me, but broke all records. And he moved from Kickstarter to BackerKit. Oops. No wonder they want a retention manager. So.
Yeah. And Brandon Sanderson is famously easy to work with. He's not what you would call a diva. If he's bailing on your platform, he probably has a good reason.
Well, yeah, $16 million. He raised $16 million on BackerKit for his new fantasy novel. So, yeah. Yeah, a lot going on in crowdfunding. Maybe next time we can take a little look, you know, peek under the hood there for that. So.
All right. Scout Comics in the news again. Or certainly on social media again.
We had to talk about this because, you know, we talked about Scout last time. Last time we were all together, the story was just breaking about how the creators were complaining about not being paid. And, you know, I did do a story on the beat where I rounded up a lot of what was being said. And I did get quotes from Brendan Dineen and James Hake, who are the principals of Scout Comics. I mean, they did give me answers to my questions. And, you know, to their credit, they addressed them. So I give them credit for that. So just as my story broke, they put out a press release that they were, teaming with a new partner and, that this new partner would lead them into a wonderland they were relaunching in the summer with a line of horror comics and, yeah, here we go. Scout Comics announces partnership with Element Media Global, a wholly owned subsidiary of Element Global Incorporated. Mm-hmm. And it's just filled with this incredibly vague, like, you know, we're partnering, we're teaming up. And I'm not even going to read Element Global's about statement because it's so lame. And so everyone was like, oh, well, I guess they got some money. That's great. I mean, you know, they're a comics publisher. Everybody loves to invest in this. So they found someone. And, you know, by the end of the day, people were like emailing me like, hey, we got something to tell you. We got something to tell you about this Element Media. And someone on Blue Sky did a very quick dive and discovered that this Element Media company is basically this one guy, Stephen Gagnon. Their headquarters is apparently his apartment. It has one employee. They have a parent company, and she found their balance sheet because they're all like OTC stocks, so they have to do financial reports. And the parent company of Element Media, which is apparently makes nutritional protein supplements, had assets of $600.
How do you even have a stock if you have assets of
$600? Well, I asked a bunch of people these questions, and the reason why they have so little money is because they made $1 million, but then they spent $999,400. Okay, which all went to the salary of this guy. But, you know, so this Blue Sky, this Blue Sky thread really just eviscerated them. So I started to dig in, and here's one thing that wasn't reported, and I think you guys will enjoy it. So for Stephen Gagnon, who is, the principal of this Element Media, he does have an about page, all right? And I'm going to read you a little bit about it because this is pretty good. Stephen Gagnon, based in L.A., regarded As an expert in the entertainment industry, he possesses over 2 decades of experience working to develop, finance, produce, and distribute virtually all forms of media. Mm-hmm. Stephen began his career in the marine industry. After obtaining his degree in marine biology, he and his family started their own marina business that spanned the East Coast. His foray into the world of entertainment came in the form of an incredible opportunity that had him hooked for life. While working at one of his properties, a film project was using Stephen's property when their funding fell apart. Understanding that he was a part of a cool opportunity, he and his company stepped up and produced the picture. Stephen Gagnon, enamored by the process and business involved, sold his marinas and began working within the sports media industry.
Wait, okay, we've skipped a step. So he's like, yes, I want to go into movies, therefore I shall go into sports media.
And also, you know, I remember Dan Nadell saying we should sell our boots, but this is the new plan for comics. Sell your marinas.
Yes.
Just sell your marinas.
There you go.
You know? Within years, had become a pioneer at the company, producing great work in the world of snowboarding and skateboarding. Over time, Stephen became more exposed to the film industry, and natural career progression led him to pursue the sector fully.
Well,
that's how I got into comics. I decided to pursue the sector very fully.
There you go. Well, the breathless account kind of worth the price of admission.
Yeah. So, sell your marinas. That's how we're going to save comics. Sell your marinas.
There you go. Okay.
Oh, boy.
Well, no doubt he's fascinated because comics have gone to the Oscars.
That's right. And Oscars have gone to comics.
Who wouldn't want to invest in them?
Right.
Well, we had a couple of animated features.
Yeah, no. Kevin and I'll...
We had a couple of animated features that were we had a couple of animated features based on really powerful comics works, including Nimona by Dee Stevenson.
Mm-hmm.
And
a film that almost didn't get all the way to completion.
Yeah, good for Netflix.
That's true. It was amazing that it. Yes, that's right. It's a much transformed film from the
book. Of course,
it's changed quite a bit. No, it's changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
From the book. I think more so than generally, even most adaptations are. But it's the animation is gorgeous. Drop dead gorgeous. Now, Robot Dreams, I haven't seen.
Well, you know, I have to admit, this flew so under the radar that when another of the 5 best animated film nominees was called Robot Dreams, and I have to admit, I sounds pretty bland name, let's be honest. And it wasn't until they showed some of the feature on the Oscar cast, I was like, that looks like Sarah Varone. Yes. And I realized it is based on Robot Dreams by Sarah Varone, which is one of the first graphic novels that First Second put out.
Uh-huh.
And it's also wordless like the book. And, PW has a delightful feature of Andy Stevenson and Sarah in conversation about their movies. But, a third movie, which didn't win, was Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse,
course, yeah.
And which is based on comics. But then the winner was, Kate.
The winner was The Boy and the Heron. Mm. So Hayao Miyazaki has gotten his second Oscar, and Toshio Suzuki is in on that Oscar as well. Given that Miyazaki said that his last film would be several films ago.
Yes, he just can't quit it.
He cannot let it go, and we are glad.
Yeah. And of course Miyazaki Sensei is also a cartoonist from time to time. Mm-hmm. In fact, he won a couple of awards for his latest quote graphic novel. That was a little controversial there, but hey, guess what? He's one of the all-time greats. So we'll let it pass time.
Let it slide for sure.
Yeah, one of the first things that comes up when you mention it in Google is The Boy and the Heron Miyazaki's last film? I would say it's his third last film.
Yeah. You know, I this isn't directly comics, but I have to say, Godzilla Minus One winning an Oscar for special visual effects. Godzilla winning an Oscar was really great.
Yeah.
I was pretty pleased by that. And so were the winners, the team, the VFX team. They were all wearing Godzilla themed shoes. And they became social media sensations
over
their
Godzilla.
One guy even had a golden Godzilla he brought with him.
Yeah. So
yeah, they went all the way. Well, congrats to all that. You know, yes. Congrats, Sarah. I'm ashamed that we hadn't recognized her accomplishment until we actually watched the Oscars, and because she's so modest, she didn't even make a big stink about it. So.
Well, that's what we're for here.
Yeah. More to come. We make a big stink. So, yes, just to wrap this up, Calvin, you're going to be gone for, next week we're doing an interview. Yeah. We already have it in the can. But then the next time that we are supposed to be together, Calvin, you won't be here.
I'm going to be, gone for 3 weeks. And I'm joining friend of the show. Jody Calkin, who got a residency, an artist residency in Venice, where actually we honeymooned 20 years ago.
That's so awesome.
It's kind of cute. It's a great trip, and she has an amazing apartment that comes with this residency. So,
I wish I was talented.
Hopefully I'll dig up some comic stuff in Venice.
All right. In 2 weeks, I will also be gone. I'll be at WonderCon. So Kate, what are you going to do?
Well, it's going to be me and Meg Lemke, and we are going to be doing an episode without the usual crew, but we'll make it work.
All right, because, as always, there will be
more
to come.
I'm gonna rustle some papers.
I think you guys should have a Patreon where you let people listen to the unedited versions of these. That's what I think.